This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, an interview with journalist David Sheen, who talks about Israel's ramping up of racist policies against African asylum seekers.
To observe that none of the bystanders who are just standing around and observing this make any effort to intervene whatsoever, like it's all good. And to me, that's the scariest part of all, when no one objects.
Also, Rami Al-Maghari reports from the Gaza Strip on the Israeli army's drone killing of two men last week. A new video report by Amnesty International highlights trigger-happy Israel's lethal ambush of a schoolboy. New music from the Gaza-based Revolution Makers, and news headlines from the month in pictures. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland, with Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza. First, we go to news headlines from our latest Month in Pictures feature. During the month of February, ongoing fighting in the area of Yarmouk Camp south of Damascus interrupted aid distribution to the approximately 20,000 remaining Palestinian refugees residing there. Various sides in the Syrian conflict had previously reached an agreement to allow aid workers to deliver supplies after several consecutive months of siege, during which dozens of residents died of starvation. Five Palestinian refugee schoolchildren in the ninth grade and a nurse on staff of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, were among the at least 18 killed when an explosive struck near an UNRWA school near Dara in southern Syria. On February 18th, at least 20 others were injured, including eight children, two of whom have lost limbs, according to a statement by UNRWA's Commissioner General. The deadly strike came, quote, just 8 days after UNRWA condemned an explosion that injured 40 schoolchildren at UNRWA's Turan school in the same town, the agency added. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces lay siege to a home in the Bir Zeit village north of Ramallah during a raid. Mu'taz Washaha, 24 years old, was killed when Israeli forces demolished part of the home and opened fire on the building after the activist affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine reportedly refused to surrender. Clashes between the Israeli army and Palestinians near Ramallah's Al Jalazon refugee camp continued after Israeli forces killed a young laborer from the camp late last month, the UN reported. Four Palestinian men were bitten by dogs used by Israeli forces at Hamra checkpoint in the northern West Bank. Israeli settlers severely beat and injured a 40-year-old Palestinian man from Al-Luban Asharqiya village near Nablus on February 11th. In the occupied Gaza Strip, a 31-year-old man was killed by Israeli forces while reportedly collecting gravel and scrap metal near the boundary with Israel, and the Israeli Air Force attempted to extrajudicially execute an alleged member of an armed group while he was traveling on a motorcycle in Deir al-Balah. The targeted man was injured along with two bystanders, according to the UN. On February 21st, Israeli forces shot and injured 12 civilians, including two children, during a protest against Israeli restrictions on Palestinian access to land near Gaza's boundary with Israel. According to the UN OCHA, quote, this type of incident has been on the rise since the beginning of the year, resulting in the injury of 40 civilians. That same day, two other Palestinians, including a 12-year-old herder, were shot and injured near the boundary with Israel in the south of the Gaza Strip. Rafah crossing was open for only 8 days from the beginning of the month through February 24th. Prior to restrictions imposed by the Egyptian government following the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi, Rafah crossing functioned as the sole exit and entry for the vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza, whose movement has been severely restricted due to long-standing Israeli closure. And those are the headlines from our latest Month in Pictures feature. For more, go to our Diaries Live from Palestine blog section on electronicintifada.net. Israeli army attacks near the boundary with Gaza have increased in the last 3 months. On Tuesday, an Israeli airstrike killed three resistance fighters in the southern city of Khan Yunus. Last Monday, an Israeli drone killed two Palestinians near a residential neighborhood in the northern Gaza Strip. The Electronic Intifada's Rami Al-Maghari has the story.
This week, the Al-Zaanin family of Beit Hanun in northern Gaza mourned their second family member killed by Israel in less than 2 months. Mus'ab al-Za'anin, along with Sharif Nasser, two young men in their early 20s, were killed by an Israeli drone inside an inhabited area that is about 2 kilometers away from the Israel-Gaza boundary fence. Sabir al-Za'anin is a brother of Mus'ab al-Za'anin. Sabir has been a peace activist for years now, taking part in a protest against Israel's buffer zone in north of the territory.
Pity him and my parents. Mus'ab had been very helpful to my parents and was always trying to make them smile. Mus'ab's death is a loss for his neighbors, as he was much loved and helpful to everyone.
An Israeli army statement said that both Sharif and Mus'ab were killed because they were preparing to fire rockets into Israel. Since 2013, armed Palestinian factions, including smaller new ones, have fired hundreds of rockets onto nearby Israeli areas, leaving no casualties but some slight material damage. Both Israel and the ruling Hamas party committed to a ceasefire brokered by Egypt back in late 2012. Israel holds Hamas responsible for the rocket fire from Gaza. Ihab al-Hussein is a spokesperson for the Hamas-led government in Gaza. Al-Hussein believes that a response by Gaza-based armed factions to Israeli attacks is just a matter of time.
They're trying to do all the politics and diplomatic ways by talking to many sides. We're talking about the Egyptians, we're talking about some UN responsibles or whatever, to make pressure on the Israelis to stop this policy. But if they won't do anything to the Israelis, I believe that the resistance movement will take a step, as I said, to have something against the Israelis, but they're trying to hold up their ways and look for the political solutions.
Last week, an Egyptian court outlawed the Hamas party and prohibited any activities of the group on Egyptian soil. This comes on top of several months of tension between the two sides, mainly after Egypt's military ousted the elected Egyptian president Mohamed Morsi last July. Dr. Mushir Amer is a political analyst in Gaza. Amer doubts Egyptian mediators would act the way they acted during the administration of the ousted president Mohamed Morsi. According to the Israeli human rights group Beit Salem, since last December, Israeli attacks, including drone and gunfire, have increased, leaving at least 8 Palestinians killed and dozens injured. The attacks come against the backdrop of Israeli threats against the coastal territory in what Israel says a response to Palestinian rocket fire into Israel. For the Electronic Intifada, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This past week, journalist and contributor to the Electronic Intifada, David Sheen, was in the San Francisco Bay Area on a U.S. tour speaking about Israel's racist treatment of African asylum seekers. Sheen's work has been featured in many different international outlets, and he's become an expert on Israel's racist attacks against Africans, documenting the situation more than any other journalist. Last December, Sheen wrote the second annual article for the Electronic Intifada, listing the Israeli officials and cultural figures most responsible for the persecution of the country's non-Jewish African population. He wrote, quote, "Over the course of 2013, the war Israel is waging against African asylum seekers has not abated. Sadly, in many respects, it has ramped up in intensity. However, some who have led the charge to expel Africans from the country have been replaced by fresh faces. National elections in January and the resultant makeup of the government pushed two of Israel's biggest racists out of the limelight. Michael Ben-Ari started his own splinter party, Strong Israel, which failed to garner enough votes to secure him a seat in Israel's parliament, the Knesset, from which he could rail against Africans. And Eli Yishai's Shas party was not invited to join Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new ruling coalition, leaving Yishai without the Interior Ministry, which wields great power over the lives of asylum seekers. But Ben-Ari passed the torch to a young acolyte who has carried on his incitement campaign and forged an alliance with the new Interior Minister. The man who replaced Eli Yishai has continued his quest to drive all African asylum seekers out of the country with the same fervor and greater media savvy. I sat down with David Sheen at UC Berkeley and asked him to talk about the current situation African refugees are facing.
The situation right now is pretty dismal. So there are about 55,000 African asylum seekers in the country, and almost hardly any of them have any rights to work in the country. So with people not being able to eke out a living, there's widespread poverty. In addition to that, the government is now rounding people up off the streets and issuing summonses that within X amount of days they have to show up at this detention center in the desert where they can be jailed there indefinitely. So people are abandoning their lives and heading down to these desert detention centers. They're incredibly depressing. As I've described, in, you know, people who have managed to smuggle out video footage talk about not even getting fruits and vegetables, any heating in the winter, hot water, showers sometimes, no basic medical services, just like the very, very basics that even, you know, murderous criminals in jail are deserving of, even that these people don't get access to in this desert detention center. So the government is trying to railroad people in, eventually hope that they become so depressed at their circumstances that they eventually give in and agree to self-deport. So the people in recent months have decided to go on strike and to put on protests. And it's fairly inspiring. It's exciting to see people stand up for their rights and demand refugee rights. And they've been quite creative and, you know, resilient. But it seems like no matter how much they protest, that they're not making any headway, at least in terms of convincing the government or the people that they should be seen as humans with human rights. So they haven't given up the fight by any stretch of the imagination, and the protests are ongoing, but it's difficult to imagine that they'll be able to put a halt to it.
David, you mentioned in your presentation here at UC Berkeley that last year the Israeli High Court issued an order saying that people should be let out of the jails and concentration camps in the desert within 3 months. What was the reaction of the Israeli Attorney General after that, and what happened to the African asylum seekers?
Mm-hmm. Well, as listeners of this podcast are probably aware, the Israeli government often does not feel obligated to comply with the orders of the High Court, and this was another instance where that occurred, where just days afterwards the Attorney General ordered law enforcement to completely disregard the Supreme Court decision and to continue arresting Africans. And so that has continued. Their status, which allows enforcement to arrest them on any basis without having access to trial, even without having to present any evidence, or it being even a serious crime, even minor crimes are enough for them to be rounded up into jails. And so that's continued. And sure enough, within 3 months, when the deadline came up for the government to release all these prisoners from jails, the government simply issued a new version of the same law, but even worse than the first, where instead of detaining people for 3 years at a time, it detains them indefinitely. So the Supreme Court, although it's often seen as some kind of, you know, liberal last resort, but it's completely disempowered, and the government just easily runs roughshod over it, and the same war on Africans continues unabated.
David, can you talk about specific policies by specific Israeli politicians and civic leaders which have resulted in incitement, violence, and pogroms in the streets of South Tel Aviv?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, some of the politicians that are the worst, the most vicious racists, no longer have the same status, but other politicians who have been, you know, issuing these intensely racist comments, some of them have been promoted to higher levels of government, in fact, to positions of power over the lives of these Africans. So Michael Ben-Ari, who's, you know, incited, and, you know, he didn't enter the last Knesset, but, and you have former interior minister Eli Yishai, who called them disease-ridden and saying that Israel belongs to the white man, that he's going to make the Africans' lives miserable until they leave, and making them responsible for AIDS and drugs and rape and murder and everything, you name it, he's accused them of it. And so he's no longer the interior minister, but Miri Regev, who famously called Africans cancer and who later apologized not to Africans for comparing them to cancer, but she apologized to cancer victims for comparing them to Africans. This woman was then appointed to be head of the Interior Committee, which is the committee that determines the fate of these African asylum seekers. So instead of these people being marginal, or, you know, they're actually promoted into positions of power, and that's the scariest part. And then, of course, you have religious leaders in the highest levels, you know, hundreds of chief rabbis across the country, issuing these racist religious edicts forbidding people from renting apartments to Africans, and them, instead of being stripped of their positions, they're rewarded with bigger budgets. And then you have these rabbis issuing more religious edicts calling any Israeli who aids the Africans or is in solidarity with them, calling them a rodef, saying that they're deserving of murder and that anyone who assassinates them is guiltless. So you have insane levels of incitement against both African asylum seekers themselves and those few Jewish Israelis and others who would be in solidarity with them. It's an incredibly scary place to be an activist and to stand up for equal rights, because the level of hatred is so great that probably the scariest part to me isn't when some, you know, foaming at the mouth racist starts, you know, screaming out, you know, in my face, but then to observe that none of the bystanders who are just standing around and observing this make any effort to intervene whatsoever. Like, it's just, it's all good. And to me, that's the scariest part of all, when no one objects.
Finally, David, you're here in the U.S. On a speaking tour during Israeli Apartheid Week across U.S. campuses. Can you talk about why it's important for college students to know about what's going on, you know, in Israeli political circles and Israeli policies, whether it's toward Palestinians or African migrants, why you're here now, and what the reaction has been to your speaking tour so far?
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason that I've come is because I feel like there are no forces in Israeli society that could possibly put an end to this. You know, no matter how much I report, I've issued over 100 resources on this topic, articles, videos, etc., but it seems that it doesn't penetrate, and the American mass media has failed. It's completely covered up this story, and that's why you haven't heard of it. Or I'm sure that readers of the Electronic Intifada have, because it's been very diligent in its coverage, and I appreciate that. But few and far between are the Americans who even know about this. And so my objective here, realizing that the government's in its endgame, and it's in the final stages of kicking out the Africans, so this is the last chance to affect policy. And policies are often decided here in the United States. It's no secret, provides Israel with not just billions of dollars of, you know, financial aid every year, military aid, but also political backing. And just yesterday, you had the Congress passing this SPA, I think they called it the Strategic Partnership Act, or Sycophantic Phallus Adoration. And in any case, whatever you call it, it's over the top, you know, 410-1 of people just giving Israel the highest possible status. No other nation in the history of the world has ever been given this accolade by the American government. And if you're going to be treating Israel as the most strategic partner, then the question is, does it align with your values? You know, and of course, there's no shortage of racism in America, and it needs to be fought wherever it crops up. But the examples of state-sponsored racism, such that I've described and reported on, are just so over the top. And of course, I've focused my reporting mainly on racism as it affects Africans, but of course, readers of the Electronic Intifada are of course familiar with the insane levels of racism, state-sponsored racism directed towards Palestinians. So Americans have to ask themselves, are these values that they want to support? I'm here to at least do my duty to let people know, to leave no stone unturned, to make sure that at least people have the opportunity to find out for themselves what's going on. And I hope that people will help spread the word. We can get past around this self-censorship of the American mass media.
Thank you so much for your work, David.
Thank you, Nora.
ايش النظام يا فخامة الشعب ناس احتلال الوطن هم فكر كهربا ما تجايا الشعب فكره ملهي في روتينه اليومي شغل كهرب صلر بنزل مقطوع في العادة بشكل يومي مش عاجبه فني لاني بوصف واقعي وانا بغني بصورة اختلاف لمستمع وانا معدي فني في اعتقاده بانتقاده في اسلوب نظمه محرمه هو منزل باسم المالك الفخامة المعظم صد الفخامة ركز حيلي مش الشعب في تغيير روتين توحيد وطن بدناش حدا يساعد حل المشاكل للاخوة بس فيلم مكبره فدخل طرف تلت عمل مختار ما حد حيعبره
رجع في بلاد ما إلها آخر بنحيا وبنموت صمدين للآخر
غزة عايشة بضجة إلها من سنين غزة دمرت سبب الكرسي يقعد عليه مين حسابنا ترسم لبعضها كمين لسه غزة عدت عد سنين في سنين بس نقدر نسرد قصة ضجة غزة ثلاث دقائق غزة للخلف لسه للخلف حتى يتمكن طب أفكار سياسية بحتى يخلق أزمة توصلهم رزقة هذه هي الحقائق متى نهتم نلتم عالطاولة بكف زيارته فوت نسمع وعود فارطة سيبك من أفكار زرعوها بعلك حزبك أفكار لمصلحتهم مش لنفسك بسأل نفسي متى نرجع نسترد أراضينا المحتلة من الخارطة
رجع في بلاد ما إلها آخر بنحيا وبنموت صمدين للآخر
حياتنا مش ماشية زي ما الكل بيفكر في مستقبل بس ما بيستقبل فالكل بيستنكر ألوان العالم شايفة بتشهد التضحية قامة للحرية بتسعد بنحضر الموت لنروح الأرض لتعود بنربط عمرنا بواحد لو كان موجود.
That was new music by the Gaza-based hip-hop group Revolution Makers. We have a link to this track and their SoundCloud page on electronicintifada.net. Samir Awad was just 16 years old when Israeli occupation forces killed him on January 15, 2013. They shot him as he fled from the place where soldiers ambushed a group of Palestinian children who were protesting against the construction of Israel's illegal separation barrier cutting across the occupied West Bank village of Budrus. A new brief video from Amnesty International highlights the killing of Samir as one of several where Israeli occupation forces have carried out willful killings which could amount to war crimes. The video was released to complement Amnesty's recent report entitled Trigger Happy Israeli Army and Police Use Reckless Force in the West Bank. As Amnesty states, quote, initially the Israeli army claimed that its soldiers had thwarted an attempted infiltration into Israel by a Palestinian. But this was not true. Amnesty notes that eyewitnesses attested that Samir Awad and the other children were posing no serious threat to the soldiers who fired at them or to others. Yet more than 1 year later, the Israeli authorities have failed to ensure any accountability for his death or for their soldiers' use of live fire against Samir Awad and the other children. Samir Awad's case was also recently investigated by Human Rights Watch, which highlighted it as an example of a shocking pattern of Israeli occupation soldiers deliberately lying in ambush for Palestinian children near their schools. As Lina Al-Safan reported for the Electronic Intifada at the time, quote, the soldiers were hidden from view in trenches near Israel's wall before shooting him the first time. As Samir tried to run away, he was shot again and again. Ayad Morar, a leader of the popular resistance against the wall, told Al-Safan that, quote, the soldiers had set up two ambushes for Samir and were hidden well. They suddenly reappeared, grabbed him, but Samir managed to get away for a few meters before he was shot by live ammunition in his legs. The soldiers in the other trench then shot him in the back and head. This was an assassination. Their intention was to kill, not to capture or arrest him. And now here's Amnesty International's video report entitled Trigger Happy Killing in the West Bank.
January 2013. Amid frantic scenes, doctors try to save a Palestinian youth who'd been shot several times by the Israeli Defense Forces. Samir Awad died on the operating table. He was just 16. He was shot close to an Israeli fence that cuts across Palestinian land on the outskirts of Budrus in the West Bank. Samir, who had just finished a school science exam, planned to go and protest along with friends. Malek Marar had gone with him.
The gates were open and they had set a trap of more than 10 soldiers. When he came, they shot him with the first bullet in the foot in that area. Then he ran away but fell over as he couldn't continue due to his injury.
Initially, the IDF claimed that the soldiers had thwarted an attempted infiltration into Israel by a Palestinian.
Samir's school teacher. If they had wanted to arrest him, they could have shot him in the leg with rubber bullets. They could have, but it seems they planned to assassinate him.
They threw a stun grenade at him. Because it was so loud, he jumped up. As he did that, they shot 3 bullets at him. He bled for 20 minutes. They never tried to help him.
Shot in the back, Samir lay bleeding to death until help arrived from the town. He was rushed to hospital.
Lufti Awad, Samir's father. I saw him at the hospital morgue. The police came as well as other officials. They showed me the boy. He was shot in the head, the leg, and from one side out through the other. We started the funeral in Ramallah. Everyone from the village participated, in addition to people from outside the village. The funeral was like a wedding for him.
IDF rules of engagement state that soldiers can only use live ammunition as a last resort. In the past 12 months, the IDF has killed 22 civilians and 4 were children. Samir's schoolteacher is in no doubt as to the effect his pupil's death has had on the other students.
Every time they hear gunshots after the killing of Samir, they fall silent. There is a negative effect on their psychology. It creates confusion and leads to a reduction in learning and achievements in their studies.
Of course, every time we see the army, we feel compelled towards resistance. The anger inside us starts to well up when they kill innocent youths who love God. Why would they kill him? Arrest him, but why kill him?
You can see the influence that this has had by the graffiti writing on the walls. And maybe you can say the students want to follow Samir's path in confronting this.
If we youths could have weapons and if we could kill them, maybe we would, but then we would become killers like them. There is God and he will judge them, but the soldier who killed him and the ones who ordered it should be punished and sentenced in the international and criminal courts.
An official investigation into the killing of Samir Awad was launched a year ago, but it has yet to publish its findings. Amnesty International believes that this incident is one of several where the IDF has carried out willful killings which could amount to war crimes.
That was a video report by Amnesty International. For more and to watch the video, go to our Rights and Accountability blog section on electronicintifada.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and we're now on iTunes, so be sure to subscribe and have the EI podcast automatically downloaded. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.